Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Contessa Brewer in for Brian Sullivan. Right now on Last Call, Boeing whistleblower.
Effectively, they are putting out defective airplanes.
That's the Boeing whistleblowers laying out shocking allegations in front of Congress. One of the lawmakers there joins us here on what happens next. Plus, something rare and strange happened in the market today, and it could mean the bears are back in charge. Waiting on Netflix, the one thing that could send the stock soaring or tumbling tomorrow. Alcoa shimmers after reporting results, but could new U.S. tariffs on China shift its outlook? The CEO joins us. Storms slam one giant insurer, and it could end up costing you big money. Plus, ejected for life. Another betting scandal rocks the NBA and raises fresh questions on sports gambling's rapid rise. We have all that and more over the next hour. Last Call is up right now. Good evening here on the East Coast and good afternoon to you out West. First up on Last Call, if at first you don't succeed, try again, or maybe it's just don't take no for an answer. Tesla once again asking shareholders to approve CEO Elon Musk's $56 billion pay package only months after a Delaware court voided it, finding the deal deeply flawed. In an effort to boost shareholder support, Tesla has even launched a website, supportteslavalue.com, touting Musk's performance at the company. And it's asking shareholders to approve plans to reincorporate in Texas. Tesla is currently incorporated in Delaware. Now, when the package originally was introduced in 2018, many in the press ridiculed it as insane and delusional and high risk. And you'd have to remember the package itself never guaranteed a $56 billion payout for Musk. Instead, Tesla had to hit key milestones, one of which was the company had to be worth more than $650 billion. When shareholders originally approved that deal, the electric automaker was valued at about $52 billion. So it seemed like, you know, a long shot. But Musk did it. At its peak in 2021, it was worth $1.2 trillion. And even with the big declines, it's worth $495 billion as of today's close. But that's a big decline. The vote will take place at Tesla's annual shareholder meeting June 13th. Does Musk deserve the compensation shareholders originally approved? With us tonight for more, Wedbush Securities Managing Director Dan Ives and Gerber Kawasaki's President and CEO Ross Gerber. Thank you both for being here on Last Call. All right. So, Dan, today you published a note saying that Tesla will reapprove the package, reincorporate in Texas. And you warned if Musk doesn't turn things around, things at Tesla could see darker days ahead. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, well, first, Musk deserves this. This is on shareholders voted on. And it really was one of the biggest turnarounds that we've seen really in the history of public companies. If for Musk, look, this is a fork in the road period. I mean, we go into earnings next week. It's been dark days in terms of what we've seen. Deliveries were a train wreck. And you look at the cost cutting. This is something that's gone from a Cinderella story to, in the near term, a horror show. Musk needs to turn this around next week. But this compact needs to get approved.
Do you think he should have even let this happen, the arguments over his compensation at this point? I mean, it is a distraction from other. I just mentioned Tesla's stock or its market cap went from 1.2 trillion down to below 500 billion now. There's a lot on that plate.
Yeah. And I think also he's created, I'd say, about 30% of that, right, in terms of what we've seen on X, as well as some of the distractions in AI, the 25% that potentially he was going to take. But this is something that they are facing massive headwinds. And as Ross will talk about, but at the end of the day, Musk is Tesla. Tesla is Musk. he needs to continue to be CEO for what I believe next 5-7 years.
Ross, you were on this program last night, just scathing in your assessment of the board of directors of Tesla. But then we went scouring through Twitter, and it turns out that back in the day, you thought that that package, the compensation for Elon Musk, was pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I benefited greatly from Musk's performance personally and for my firm. And I'm super grateful for Tesla as an investment. At the time, I voted for it. And I don't actually have any belief that he doesn't deserve it. But I think the issue is that the board had a flawed process. And just by trying to just reapprove this, have they shown that the process was done better in any way? And just reincorporating in another state is basically like saying, well, we just don't care. We'll just reapprove it and move somewhere else. But maybe we get more lawsuits and distractions because of it. And so I think for me, it's not whether he deserves it or not. It's whether this board of directors can actually have any credibility with anybody.
What do you predict would happen if a bunch of directors on this board resigned and said, okay, you know what, maybe we're not right in the best interest of this company or other stakeholders? What do you anticipate would happen then to Tesla if you had a real change in leadership?
Well, I don't think that's the leadership. I think Elon Musk should be CEO of Tesla. And actually, the board of directors should just require that he work at Tesla like every other CEO. That's a different issue. But that's actually what needs to happen, is several board members have to, you know, understand that they're conflicted and they need to resign. And then truly independent directors, which I do not want to be, I just want to make it very clear, but truly independent directors should be appointed. And then a compensation committee is created that then can review this process in an independent way and then produce a new proxy that would be voted on by shareholders. And even if the terms are the same, maybe have some covenants involving, you know, coming to work. I don't know. But and certainly not tweeting. But I don't think that's going to happen. And I think it's Elon's company. And I invested in Elon's company 5 years ago. I benefited greatly from it. And he deserves his package. But the bottom line is their process is broken.
Look, I'd agree with Ross on the board side. I mean, this has been, it's been a debacle for the ages in terms of the board. And I think even though we could blame Musk for some of this, I think the board's been asleep at the wheel. And I think this is something from an investor perspective, you need action. And I believe this is really clock struck midnight. And this is going to be what I believe is going to be a white knuckle period ahead, not just for Musk, but for the board.
I know that you want more focus here on robo-taxi, autonomous driving, where the AI lies. Are you clear if a bunch of shareholders get together and say, no, we meant it when we voted for this pay package? Are you clear how that works with the judge saying no and the shareholders once again saying yes?
Well, I mean, them going to Texas essentially makes that null and void in terms of, look, the Delaware, I think, was viewed by and is an embarrassment by many just in terms of that actual action. But they go to Texas, this gets voted on, that at least removes this overhang. But again, an Everest like uphill.
And another,
climb.
Ross, you think another lawsuit pending if
I mean, I don't think Texas law is that different, and they're trying to be like Delaware and attract business. So it goes in front of a judge. I mean, there's so many lawyers in this country that just can't wait to sue. So, you know, Elon's defending probably like 100 cases already. So, you know, the truth is, I just think it exposes them, and they need to be, you know, smarter about their strategy for employing things. And I think that's really the issue. The board of directors is so conflicted. They've had so many issues, including the lawsuit over their compensation, where they're still having to give back $750 million of compensation. That is an absurd amount by any board's history. So we know these people are just need to be removed or replaced. And that's what would create an end to this overhang. And then exactly, Musk is going to be Musk, but the board has an obligation to do what's best for Tesla. And that's really what I'm trying to say. We have to do what's best for Tesla. And I think Elon working at Tesla is what's best for Tesla, but he's got to do that.
I wanted to ask you, Dan, as we're talking about what's happening with Tesla, another story that we were watching unfold in the markets today was a real headwind for chips. I mean, NVIDIA way down. What's happening?
I think just risk off that we're seeing, you know, with the 10-year and just worries about what's happening in tech. But I do believe we are going to go into a tech earnings season that's going to be robust across the board. The AI revolution's here. We view this more as a golden buying opportunity rather than the time where I view tech is structurally declining from here.
All right. Dan Ives, thank you for joining us. Ross Gerber, great to see you. Thank you, gentlemen. Let's take a look at what happened to your money today. The Dow dropping 45 points. The S&P 500 was down about 0.5% after starting the day in the green. And the NASDAQ down more than 1%. Listen, there's an interesting market stat that Ryan Dietrich pointed out to us. He notes that since 1990, there have been only 20 other times the S&P 500 opened in the green and then closed in the red for three consecutive days. That happened today. Is that a bearish sign with negative returns on an average month later? Are the bulls finally losing some control here? We'll watch. Wait. On to our studs and duds, the biggest winner of the day, United Airlines, up 17.4%. Look at that. Biggest loser, though, J.B. Hunt Transport Services, it plummeted more than 8%. Let's get a look at futures as we speak. And right now, they're all in the green. S&P futures, slightly so. Same thing with Dow Jones futures. I mean, that's essentially flat. NASDAQ futures up 0.33%. Coming up, a sports gambling scandal so bad, the NBA just did something it hasn't done in 70 years. Plus, Boeing whistleblowers reveal eye-opening allegations to Congress. One of the lawmakers sitting on the desk tells us what comes next. That's ahead.
People today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older. Like a family vacation.
Cannonball!
Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.
Tomorrow's News Tonight and the stories you and Wall Street will be talking about. First up, we have, and this was breaking just moments ago, Cleveland Fed President Loretta Mester commenting on inflation during a forum this evening, saying the central bank wants to be confident that inflation is heading to 2% before cutting rates. And she also says the Fed is in no hurry to cut rates. We've basically heard the same thing from Jerome Powell. Meanwhile, Las Vegas Sands reporting earnings after the bell today. The casino operator posted a beat, but comments over how upcoming summer renovations to some of its Macau properties affect room occupancy are sending shares lower after hours. While LVS operates five properties in Macau, Singapore is the major moneymaker for the company. In fact, it set new records, not just for the company, but for the whole industry last quarter. Marina Bay Sands in Singapore earns just slightly less this quarter than all five Macau properties combined. And finally, investors are awaiting Netflix earnings due out after the closing bell tomorrow. We expect to get updated subscriber counts as well as ad revenue numbers from the streaming giant. Now, of course, the street is estimating about 4 million additional subscribers in the first quarter. What else can they expect? Who knows better than CNBC media reporter Julia Boorstin in studio. It's great to have you here. When you're looking at the earnings call itself and the earnings report, subscribers are always like the primary thing we get to. But now they have this ad tier. How much color are we going to get on the money they're making through ads?
Well, I think that the ad tier and the subscriber numbers are related, because if they can get people who otherwise would have dropped Netflix to just downshift to the lower cost ad-supported tier, then that's going to actually grow their subscriber numbers. Netflix has been doing this huge crackdown on password sharing, and that's one reason they had such massive subscriber growth in the fourth quarter. Over 13 million new subscribers in Q4 that blew past all expectations. Part of that was because they were cracking down on password sharing, and it was working. They also could crack down on password sharing and say, hey, if you don't want to pay full freight, let's give you a lower cost option. So I think the key thing about the ad-supported business is it's all about growing the overall subscriber business. Now, they won't give, I would suspect that they won't give a huge amount of transparency. What they did say is that about 30% of all new signups were for the ad-supported version. So they would give some sense of that there is traction there, but they haven't given massive transparency around the ad business yet. And I would say that's because it's still really early days. I think in a year, we're going to get a ton of transparency, because then they'll really be at scale.
Other streamers are pushing hard into live sports, Apple, Amazon, Peacock. Where does Netflix's plans, that's hard to say, include live sports? And could they, for instance, land a contract to have NBA?
Well, everyone's talking about the NBA rights because they're being negotiated right now. And the key thing about Netflix is it's always said we don't want to bid for these very expensive sports rights. They have all the sports adjacent content, the documentaries, all of the sort of content about sports, but not the sports itself. So like the F1 documentary was a perfect example of that. But they've also started to do this other thing where they actually create their own sporting events. Boxing matches, or they'll create a sort of a golf tournament. And this is their own generated content. They are not paying to license this content. I suspect that they're going to be asked questions about this. And I suspect they'll say, we'd like to do this our own way and not be beholden to someone like the NBA. Having said that, I would be surprised if Netflix wasn't even poking around a little bit at those NBA rights.
Especially with engagement numbers up the way they are, viewership numbers skyrocketing as well. It's great to see you. I know you have a busy day tomorrow because it's the first ever CNBC Changemakers event in New York City. And Julia, you're the guru of this big event. We're going to hear from CNBC Changemakers and other special guests sharing how they are reshaping business, redefining leadership. Here's the QR code. If you want to learn more, there's still time. You can visit cnbcevents.com/changemakers. Congratulations. I'll see you there tomorrow.
Thank you so much, Contessa. I really appreciate it.
Still ahead, Boeing whistleblowers are laying out bombshell allegations in front of Congress. What will lawmakers do now? One of them, who was there, joins us next.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
A tense hearing on Capitol Hill today as the Boeing whistleblower answered questions from lawmakers over his claims that the Boeing 787 Dreamliner is not safe to fly. CNBC's Phil LeBeau joins us now. So what kind of details came out in the hearing today, Phil?
Some decent number of details that we hadn't heard before, but there are really two hearings today, Contessa, on Capitol Hill focused on Boeing. The first one, which you're referencing, involves the whistleblower. This is him, Sam Salapour. Still works for the company, by the way. He blasted the company, outlining cases where he believes the company was in the pursuit of profits, pushing out planes that he calls defective.
In a rush to address its bottlenecks in production, Boeing hit problems, pushing pieces together with excessive force to make him appear that the gaps don't exist, even though they exist. The gap didn't actually go away, and this may result in premature fatigue failure. Effectively, they are putting out defective airplanes.
Sam Salapour talking about the 787 and his claims that there may be fuselage fatigue there. The other hearing involved Boeing's safety culture. The company put out a statement afterwards saying, we take the FAA review panel's detailed assessment to heart and will act on their findings and feedback. Since 2020, Boeing has been has taken important steps to foster a safety culture that empowers and encourages all employees to raise their voices. We know we have more work to do. We are taking action across our company. We'll probably find out more about what Boeing is doing and plans to do when the company reports its Q1 results. That is next week. That's going to really be the next benchmark time when we hear from the company about what's happening, certainly with everything swirling around its safety culture. And one last note, Contessa, Mike Whitaker, FAA administrator, he took some heat today. His agency did, at least, at both hearings with regards to the question about whether or not the FAA is doing enough when it comes to the oversight of Boeing. We reached out to the FAA. It defends its oversight of Boeing, saying, oh, it's not business as usual at Boeing, and we are proactive in terms of our work, in terms of making sure they follow the rules.
I know you were following that hearing closely, so, Phil, stay with me as I bring in Wisconsin Senator and Permanent Subcommittee Ranking Member on the Subcommittee on Investigations, Senator Ron Johnson joins me now. Senator, it's good to see you. So you heard from the whistleblower today. I know you went in with concerns. You said so in your opening statement. So what's next?
Well, one of my primary concerns, I don't want to be scaring the bejesus out of the public here. We need to be very careful and thoughtful in terms of how we present this information. But in preparation for the hearing, I just have to admit that the testimony was beyond troubling. But again, we need to hear from all the stakeholders. This is very early on. I'm not sure I would have held a hearing as soon if I were chairman. But again, this is Chairman Blumenthal's call. And again, this is something we have to look into. There's no doubt about it. But we've got to be talking to the airlines. We need to be talking to pilots. We need to be talking to mechanics. We need to be talking to the FAA. This is a very complex issue. First, everybody wants Boeing to succeed. We have to have Boeing succeed. We want, you know, safety in the sky. So this has to be fully vetted. We need to make sure that Boeing has a culture of safety. I'm not sure it has had one. I'm not sure the current management is up to it. That's, I think, one of the troubling reports I entered in the record is just talking about how, you know, the CEO is one place, COFO another place. Again, it just seems like a dysfunctional company. More concerned potentially about DEI. They score great in terms of FEC reports, in terms of accomplishing other DEI and ESG goals. They don't score well in terms of their own quality goals that they set. So again, it's just very troubling. But I try and take comfort in the fact that airline travel is still the safest form of travel. You know, I'm traveling all the time. I'm almost exclusively flying Boeing 737s. I really looked into or questioned a lot about the 737 MAX issue. I didn't find much comfort in the fact that Boeing engineers hid MCAS system from FAA regulators. I mean, you know, why nobody was prosecuted there? I know they have this deferred prosecution agreement. That needs to be looked at as well. So again, there are so many questions that need to be answered here. There's so much investigation that has to occur. I just don't trust government agencies to really be on top of this. And right now, sure, I've got a lot of questions for Boeing, airlines, and everybody involved in this.
Senator, this is Phil LeBeau. Both Boeing and the FAA put out statements after these hearings today, and they both said the same thing, essentially, that they are working hard, ensuring that safety is the number one thing on their list. Are they doing enough, in your opinion, right now?
Of course, that's exactly what you'd think a comms department would put out, that kind of statement. You know, I actually quoted an NBC report that talked about how Boeing stress tests a 787, in effect, 165,000 takeoff and landings, inspected almost two-thirds of their existing fleet of 727s, saw no fatigue. I didn't get a real good answer out of the witnesses in terms of, well, does this not count toward anything? So that's why I say I've just got way more questions. I'm not willing to make any pronouncements at this point in time at all, other than this needs to be looked into with a great deal of detail and care.
And Senator, you've reached out to Boeing CEO Dave Calhoun, their new chairman, Steve Mollenkopf. I'm not sure if you've reached out to him. Two questions. A, have you had a conversation with either of these gentlemen? And B, are you getting the information that you need? Or at some point, do you say, that's it, we need you on Capitol Hill now to answer questions?
Again, this is so early in our committee's oversight and investigation of this. I spoke to a couple airline CEOs. I spoke to representatives of Boeing. But again, this is just so early. I'm not faulting Chairman Blumenthal for holding this hearing. I would have held off. I would have wanted to gather more information before I hold this public hearing. Because I'm concerned about raising public concern above a level that it really needs to be.
Senator Johnson, it's good of you to join us today. Phil LeBeau, thank you for bringing us the report and sticking around as well. It's a story that we'll continue to follow here at CNBC and certainly on Last Call. Coming up, the betting scandal shocking the NBA. Are sports leagues doing enough to stop illicit activity by the players themselves? Plus, Vince McMahon has sold hundreds of millions of dollars of WWE shares, and now we may know why. Stay with us. You know what we have for you tonight? It's a bonus Tomorrow's News Tonight. Chip giant Micron is set to get more than $6 billion in CHIP Act grants. The announcement expected to come next week, according to Bloomberg. The money will be used for domestic factory projects here in the United States. Micron is building factories in Idaho and New York State. After hours, Micron shares are seeing a jump into the green, up 2% in the aftermarket trading on this news. It's been nearly 3 months since Vince McMahon left the WWE after a former employee accused him of sexual abuse and trafficking. And now we're learning more about how he's spending his time. According to our own Alex Sherman, McMahon is taking lavish vacations and staying in touch with former President Donald Trump as the WWE tries to move on from this scandal-plagued ex-CEO. Alex Sherman joins me in studio tonight. Okay, so vacations and hobnobbing with a former would-be, once again, president seems like he's not taking his time, like, licking his wounds.
Yeah, look, and maybe hobnobbing with the former president may be an over-exaggeration. In fact, his representatives came out and said, like, yeah, they spoke. They talked last year, but, like, you know, they're not necessarily
no
tight exactly.
Okay.
But look, what he's doing is he's living his life, and he's not trying to interject himself back into the company, which I think is an interesting question because, look, WWE is his life. I mean, he purchased that company from his dad in 1982. He clearly was extremely involved with the company, ran creative, CEO, on the board. You know, he was off the board, then he was back on the board, then he sold the company, which merged with UFC and became TKO, publicly traded now. But from what I was able to gather through the reporting of this, he is truly out. One source of mine said it's over for him now. So he's on to his life and he's, you know, eating at restaurants and we'll see what happens with this lawsuit. And he is still in touch with John Cena and The Rock. Both Chloe Melas and I have reported. She's on the NBC side and I on the CNBC side co-reported this story. But it does seem as though life is actually moving on for him.
You know, it's interesting because when you see, I'm going to call him a founder for this discussion,
yeah,
and
fair.
I know it's his dad,
yeah,
it was his dad's
yeah.
company. But when you see people at the center of their companies moving on, a lot of times they just fall off. But their legacy and the way they operated the company, they had established a culture that lives on. What about at the WWE?
Yeah, so he certainly established a culture. And one of the interesting things I found out about this is I think parts of that culture are dissipating. They are disappearing without him
like
there.
What?
He had a reputation for being capricious. You know, if things didn't go right with a match, people felt like they might be fired the next day. That whole world, I'm told by multiple sources, is going away, which is good in a way for the company, right? It's like, look, this chilling effect on there about the fear of throwing out new ideas or if something does go wrong, will I lose my job? That's not there anymore. And that makes people at the company more comfortable with trying out new things. And I think we saw some of that at WrestleMania earlier this month, where I think a lot of people that really follow wrestling saw some things that may not have been done during the Vince McMahon era. But I will say that when Endeavor bought WWE, they also said, well, one of the big reasons we wanted this company was Vince McMahon, and we want him in. So, you know, there's a little bit of push and pull here. Of course, they needed to woo him, and they wanted that asset. But now you're hearing from people that are at the company that are actually saying, you know what, we're kind of glad he's gone.
So the smackdown against Vince McMahon may have been successful.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Thank you, Alex. The Shohei Ohtani saga isn't the only betting scandal rocking sports. Today, the NBA banned Toronto Raptors forward Jontay Porter for life after a league investigation determined he bet on games, passed on key information to gamblers, and even claimed to be sick so that he could throw a game. In that instance, the league found that somebody that had known of the illness bet $80,000 on Porter to underperform in that game. By the way, the $80,000 was not paid out. Porter claimed that he got sick when he was only 3 minutes into the game, and the bet would have paid out more than $1 million, but the NBA says the wager was frozen, as I said, not paid out. The league also found that Porter placed 13 bets on NBA games using someone else's betting account. The bets ranged from $15 to $22,000. He wagered more than $54,000 and generated nearly $22,000 in net winnings from what we know. And by the way, did bet against his own team. Never for them, but against them. For more on the latest gambling scandal, let's bring in investor and sports bettor himself, Danny Moses. He's the founder of Moses Ventures, was portrayed in the Big Short movie. And I know you're like, you do a podcast about all of this, Dave, too, on the tape. All right. When we're talking about Jontay Porter, he's not a well-known player. He doesn't make a lot of money. He had like this dual contract where he's somewhat playing with the Toronto Raptors and then playing for the minor league, G League.
Yep.
Is it a big deal for sports? Is it a big deal for gambling that this player got caught?
Yes, it's a big deal. His brother is a big player, right? He's much more well-known in the world of the NBA, but it is a big deal. And this has been going on for years, right? Before we saw the legalized sports gambling market occur, imagine what's been going on. There's been scandals every year. College basketball, you go back to, you know, go back in time and look, and you think about the NBA in general. Tim Donaghy, the referee, was fixing games in 2007, right? So we know this is a history here.
Because I cover gambling, I just want to point out those scandals, Pete Rose getting banned from baseball, that happened before sports betting was widespread in terms of legalized. It was, you know, it may have been widespread, but it wasn't legal to do it. What the legal industry says now, and in fact, I got a statement from DraftKings, if we can pull that up. What they say is this shows that if you have a legal system, we can spot the problems. Here it is. DraftKings is proud to have played a role in identifying and bringing to light suspicious activity to the league. It's a prime example of the regulated market working as intended, that they're going to work closely with the industry and the leagues so that players can enjoy this. Okay, great. Aren't there always offshore illegal books that you can go to if you want to gamble?
Sure. But the NBA has a big problem here because all the sports in general have been making so much money from the advent of gambling. Think about sports media rights, TV deals. Why do you think the value of the average NBA team has gone
increased from viewership, increased
engagement?
$2.5 billion
to $4 billion in the last 3 to 4 years. A lot of it has to do with that. So it's hard. They're getting licensing fees from licensing that data to the bookmakers
themselves.
Well, what's
the jeopardy for the leagues then? Like, I know that they talk about integrity, but would you really lose viewers if there's questions about whether the basketball players are gambling?
No, but they need a policy. And listen, it should be an obvious policy that you shouldn't be gambling on games. There actually are federal laws that are broken if you fix a game versus just betting on a game and it's a conduct violation, right? So there's a lot here. But again, it's not just basketball. It's many, many sports. And imagine, you only hear about the ones that are people that get caught. You can imagine how this has been going on and is going on. And yes, you can see more gambling now because it's now in the legal market versus illegal market, so it's easier to track.
Do you anticipate that given, you know, the interpreter for Shohei Ohtani, the DOJ says it had nothing to do with the baseball player himself, that it's not a baseball scandal. It was an interpreter stealing money from his friend slash employer scandal. But is there going to be backlash? Is there going to be the kind of regulation, maybe even federally, that interferes with the ability to turn a profit for these legal books?
I think that story about Ohtani and his interpreter is not done yet. Not that I'm saying he's involved at all, Ohtani. What I'm saying is, what was the interpreter betting on? How could you know exactly what was going on if it was not in the lit market, so to speak, in the legal market? So, you know, I think we're going to see this thing play out over a period of time, and there's going to be rules and guardrails that are put in place. But think about this. The majority of bets that are occurring now are not on the outcome of a game. They're on the in-game live wagering and on certain players, right? So it's just very different. But
is the business of sports betting a good bet right now?
Yes, it is because of the tax revenue it's providing, believe me, the genie's out of the bottle here. This is not going back, right? So we got to move it forward and just put guardrails on it and make sure that these players obviously adhere. And listen, people get approached. Think about a college basketball player on a non-top 50 team that may get approached by a bookie or somebody else that wants to share. How easy that is for a kid who knows he's never going to make money in the future. Yeah. It's an integrity thing. So I think that the integrity needs to work its way through the entire industry, including the league.
Yeah, and by the way, Adam Silver said today, we're going to have to look at the kinds of bets that are offered. He was alluding to these prop bets that then would allow players to...
One more irony in that. The next expansion team for the NBA is supposed to be Las Vegas. So let's see how
that
works.
We'll wait and see if that happens. Danny Moses, thanks. Coming up, Alcoa shares on the move on the back of fresh results. Could new U.S. tariffs on China alter its outlook? The CEO joins us next. Here's your watch list. Tonight, we're looking at travelers. Shares of the insurance giant tumbled today. Despite results that were pretty good on the surface, it hiked its dividend also by 5%. So what's the problem? Catastrophe losses. They were significant. $712 million, a 33% spike from a year earlier, and most of that from thunderstorms. And this is what all insurers and customers probably are going to pay attention to. Travelers says that materials, labor, and replacement costs, though they've come down from last year, they're still higher. Costs from lawsuits are increasing, and severe storm damages are real. These thunderstorms, they're very hard to model, but the wind and the hail are expensive. And that is changing the way insurers think about pricing coverage for homeowners. They flat out said on their earnings call today that the rate hikes for homeowners insurance will continue. Turning now to Alcoa earnings just out after the bell. Shares climbing after hours. The company's first quarter revenue exceeded expectations. Alcoa, however, posted a wider-than-anticipated loss. With me tonight, CNBC's Morgan Brennan and Alcoa president and CEO William Oplinger in a first on CNBC interview. Morgan?
Contessa, thank you. And Bill, it's so great to speak with you. Thanks for joining us on the heels of earnings.
Hi, Morgan. Thanks for having me on.
So I do want to get into the quarterly results, but first, your reaction to the news of the day, the fact that President Biden earlier today called for what would essentially be a tripling of tariffs on Chinese metal imports, including aluminum. What does that do for the market here, both in the U.S. and globally?
The tripling of the tariffs are essentially on a fairly small sub-segment of the aluminum that comes into the States. And while it's small, we think it's a benefit to many of our customers here in the U.S., so we're supportive of it. But probably more importantly, we're seeing demand growth in all of our major markets, whether it's in the U.S., North America, Europe, and China. We're seeing real pickup and strong demand across all of our major regional markets and across all of our industries. And so that's in building construction, automotive, electrical transmission. So we're seeing real good demand growth on a year-over-year basis.
Yeah, and certainly that was the headline from the results today. I wonder what you think is propelling it. Is it a reflection of stronger than expected economic growth in markets like the U.S., or is it a secular shift, a spending shift when we do talk about things like, for example, infrastructure spending and other areas where aluminum is going to be required?
I think it's all of the above, plus the energy transition that's going on around the world. So again, where we see some of the strength was in the packaging business. See it in automotive has remained strong, even in building and construction, which in 2023 was a difficult market. We're seeing a rebound and a stabilization in building and construction. And then as I go out into the future, aluminum is a critical part to the energy transition. When we look at electric vehicles, the modernization of the grids around the world, aluminum growth by 2050, one of the major prognosticators says by 2050, we'll see aluminum demand growth grow by 80%. So really, really good underlying dynamics in the marketplace.
Mm. So we can talk about improved market dynamics, but you're also focused on improving the financials in the company, looking to cut $100 million in costs from Alcoa this year. How is that process going, and how does that position you just in time for this recovery?
So I'm really pleased with a lot of the progress that we made in the first quarter in the company. So if you look at some of the things, you referenced the fact that we have announced a $100 million competitiveness program. We've launched that throughout the system. All the plants, all departments have targets that they'll hit. We're going to hit that $100 million run rate benefit by the first quarter of 2025. On top of that, we announced a major acquisition in the first quarter, $2.2 billion acquisition of a joint venture partner in located in Australia, will significantly streamline the company and make the equity story around us much, much easier. On top of that, we were able to make progress on a number of key strategic initiatives. So aside from the revenue beat in the quarter, the margin beat in the quarter, really pleased with the progress that we made around the strategic initiatives.
And, of course, you're referencing the Illumina Limited acquisition. Do you continue to be acquisitive, especially when you do think about, I guess, taking on further control of your supply chain and continuing to become more vertically integrated?
Well, let's get the Illumina Limited transaction done first. We announced it in the first quarter. We've been working on it for a long time. We should have it completed, in our view, by the third quarter of this year. After that, we'll continue to focus on optimizing the portfolio that we have, taking cost out, making the plants much more competitive. And this is the first step towards a really good growth of the company.
All right. Bill Oplinger, CEO and president of Alcoa, thanks for joining us here on the heels of earnings with shares trading higher.
Appreciate it.
Post-market. Thanks.
Thank you.
Contessa?
Morgan, thank you for bringing us that. It's Gen Z's key to financial security. The answer probably isn't what you think. Welcome back. Young adults in the U.S. ages 18 to 34 are more likely than any other generation to say that owning their own business is key to financial security. That's according to a new CNBC Global Your Money survey. As part of its financial education initiative, CNBC, in partnership with Junior Achievement, brought together business leaders to discuss founding a company as a possible career path. CNBC's Sharon Epperson has a look at how this career exploration program in Denver aims to inspire high school students to become entrepreneurs.
Here at the Junior Achievement Free Enterprise Center in Denver, students from area high schools are learning from local entrepreneurs about what it takes to start your own business.
Never say no.
Camila Uzcategui founded Vitro 3D while a graduate student at the University of Colorado Boulder. She says a key to developing the company's 3D printing light technology was learning from failure.
In all of those challenges, I kind of like to see them as opportunities to either, you know, pivot into a potentially new direction or pivot into a better way of understanding something.
Moa Hale believes ownership is key to building wealth.
For me, I just knew that if I didn't take that step to be an entrepreneur, that I would really regret it.
Hale founded Sky Blue Builders during the Great Recession in 2009.
The main thing is having passion about what you do. And so as long as you have that passion, any obstacles that you have, you can overcome.
He wanted his 50-person team to have a stake in the construction company, too. So he recently made a deal with outside vendors to convert his firm to an employee-owned business. Robin Wise has led Junior Achievement Rocky Mountain for 3 decades. She says programs at this center help students visualize their futures to achieve their goals and impact their community.
It's not the sit and get kind of thing. Some of these things can't be taught. They have to be caught.
These high school students say here they're opening their minds to new ideas.
Expands my dreams that I didn't even know that I probably had.
The word that brought up for me was bold, which I thought was very cool.
Everything is not going to go your way, no matter what you do. So just always lift up your head and just keep pushing.
Nearly 5.5 million businesses were started in the U.S. last year, the most on record, according to the Census Bureau. These students could drive those numbers even higher one day, Contessa.
You know, it's interesting. My mom, who was a lifelong teacher, said to me, I'm sort of on this cusp of thinking that we shouldn't be teaching all of this trigonometry and algebra and whatever. We should be teaching finance and entrepreneurship to fund and to see success in the next generation of young adults. Who funds this program?
Well, the people who understand that that's the next generation, entrepreneurs. This program, this free enterprise center in Denver, just opened last year, $18.5 million for this facility to open, and all of that money came from entrepreneurs.
Okay, so CNBC has partnered with Junior Achievement on financial education initiatives around the country. Mm-hmm. How does this Junior Achievement Program differ from that?
Well, they have a lot of different programs around the country. A lot of places have a finance park where you can go in and kind of simulate what your adult life will be like, holding down a job, making sure that you're paying your rent, what insurance do you need, all of those types of things. And they have that in Denver. But what they have and what these students were doing that day is something called the Dream Accelerator. They go into various stations and they kind of visualize what the possible career paths could be. One place is a selfie station. They figure out what some of their strengths are and how, what their aspirations are and what they are, their aptitude is now, what that could lead to for a career path. They loved it.
It sounds like an opportunity that a lot of grown-ups would jump at the chance to explore.
Exactly, absolutely. And the teachers love it for their students because they're teaching some things in the classroom, but this really gives them some hands-on experience and some opportunity to catch that inspiration from local entrepreneurs, hear what they did, how they made it, and how they can do the same.
What teachers do not love is anybody in public saying that you don't need algebra. Thank you, Sharon. Sure. It's a very special day here at CNBC. 35 years ago, this happened.
The Consumer News and Business Channel, CNBC. We're happy we have your attention, and we promise to work hard to keep it.
That was former NBC President Bob Wright on the day CNBC launched back in 1989. 12,784 days later, someone did the math. We're still in the world and we're still the leader in business news. That would not have been possible if it wasn't for you, the viewers. We will not stop working hard to keep your attention. Hopefully for another 35 years. I probably will be around and I'm going to look just like this because the Botox pays off.
Yes, we both will.
It was, you know what, you've been a big part of the growth here too. It was fun celebrating for everybody too. Thank you for watching Last Call, everybody. You'll be glad to know that Brian's back tomorrow, but I've enjoyed filling in. Shark Tank is next.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.